This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Laura Kelly, a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jay Arena, the author of the new book, Expelling Public Schools, How Anti-Racist Policies Enable School Privatization in Newark. Jay Arena, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Laura. Glad to be here.
Jay, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do in education, and how you came to this project?
Sure. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, I'm here in New Orleans, Louisiana, so down the river from Memphis, where you're broadcasting from. But I came here many years ago in the mid-80s, seems like yesterday, but it was to work as a community and labor organizer. Was involved in a number of different struggles, and those experiences kind of led me to graduate school to think a little bit more deeply about the experiences, organizing experiences that I'd been in, and to draw out the lessons for strengthening our struggles. And they had been in the context of a majority Black city just at the time Reaganism, the whole kind of right-wing offensive was hitting. And so those were kind of my experiences, my focus. And so my first book was around, and dissertation was on the destruction of public housing in pre and post Katrina New Orleans, and kind of the lessons from that, and kind of the negative role of the nonprofits in weakening social movements. And then, you know, you don't always know where you're going to end up after you graduate. And so I ended up in New York at the City University of New York, a public university, the Staten Island campus. And so I decided to live in New Jersey. If people have been there, it's kind of Staten Island, they call it the forgotten borough, because it's not really connected to the rest of the boroughs with subways. It's actually more connected to New Jersey. So I ended up in Newark, and this kind of project just fell in my lap. It was this huge struggle around public schools. And I immersed myself in that. And the product some 10 years later is Expelling Public Schools.
Great. All right. Well, let's dive into it then. So a key idea underpinning your argument is the difference between what you call racial democracy and social democracy. Can you explain the difference between these two ideas and how they operated in your case study of Newark?
Sure. Yeah, though that kind of that concept and larger theory kind of anchors the book, as you correctly pointed out. And I take this from Preston Smith, a political scientist at Holyoke College, and it's part of the larger what you could call the materialist school of post civil rights Black politics. So people like Adolph Reed Jr., Cedric Johnson, Torrey Reed, Preston Smith. This is taken from Preston Smith's book on housing struggles in Chicago in the mid 20th century. And so he looks at racial democracy. Is we could call this you know, the fight for equal opportunity within a capitalist system, right? A radical understanding, a radical equal opportunity. And maybe on its farther end, you could call it an anti-disparitarian goal of an equal distribution of the goods and bads within capitalism. And so it's not to get rid of inequality altogether, but to have it distributed on an equal basis along race, but you could extend it on gender, sexuality. And so you have 13% of African Americans are billionaires. 13% of the population, then they should be 13% of the billionaires, right? The equal distribution of the goods and bads. In contrast, social democracy, and he uses these two concepts to compare one another. Social democracy is an argument that people should have equal access to the basic necessities of life, regardless of race. So it is a kind of encompasses racial democracy, right, against any kind of form of discrimination, but also class as well. And so your money should not be an inhibitor to access to housing and education and other basic necessities. We can get into it a little bit more how that plays out, but oftentimes, and what we've seen is that only going for racial democracy undermines the ability of really achieving racial inequality. And then at other times we see in the recent times, particularly around the Sanders campaign, on how a racial democracy politics was used as a leverage against a social democratic politics.
So in the book, you argue that to really understand neoliberal school reform, including school privatization, we need to understand Black politics. What are most studies missing about Black politics?
Well, maybe we can go back a little bit on this history and then we can kind of delve into that. And so I'm looking at the context, and this is drawn from Adolf Reed's work, A Black Urban Regime, right? These are majority Black cities with the mayor and the majority of the city council being African-American who rely on a Black working class base. And these are a historical product of deindustrialization, racist housing policies, and that emerge kind of by the 1960s. Many cities like Newark were majority Black, and Puerto Rican in Newark's case. And by the 70s, you have these Black urban regimes emerging. And it's also at the same time that the federal government is reducing support for cities. And there's a move toward the whole kind of neoliberal transformation of American capitalism, of which privatization is a huge component. And so in Newark, there's a Black mayor that's elected in the 1970s. There's another mayor, that's Kenneth Gibson, and then Sharp James. And they basically attempt to follow kind of a pro-corporate, pro-business development model to attract business and investment to the central city in particular. And this did not play out very well for Black working class people. Right. But they kind of legitimated themselves as a defender of the black community. Now, with Sharp James, he's elected in 1986 and goes through till 2006. Yeah. And when Cory Booker is elected, and he, oversaw kind of this renaissance, the return of capital to Newark, to the central city. And we did see this kind of happening in many different urban centers, including majority Black centers. But he was not on board with the privatization of public schools, which kind of hits by the late 90s and early into the early 2000s. And so, and this is the context in which Cory Booker emerges. He he actually grew up in the suburbs of Newark. His family had connections with Newark. His family was a beneficiary of the gains of the civil rights movement. His parents worked in middle management, corporate management, and Xerox. They were able to buy, thanks to the, despite the discrimination they faced, buy a home in an affluent suburban neighborhood. And then he goes on to very elite education, Stanford. He got a master's in sociology. We'll give him kudos for that as a sociologist. Glad to see that. Then he gets a Rhodes scholarship to go to England. And then he comes back to top it off with a law degree at Yale. And so he arrives in the 1990s, late 90s, and he basically latches on to school privatization as the kind of key public policy. And he's promoted by, you know, very powerful forces that are behind what I consider a movement. It's the movement to privatize. It's kind of a movement from above. And this gets back to your initial question about anti-racism and racial democracy. Unlike the earlier waves to impose kind of the neoliberal agenda, attacks on welfare, for example, that used a real racist edge, the movement to privatize public education, some way similar to public housing, couched it as an anti-racist initiative, right? We want to end inequalities in education, the gap, the racial outcome gap between Black and Latino students and white students. And so key to that was providing choice. As an earlier broadcast you had on vouchers, but also with charter schools. And so that was defined as the civil rights movement of our day. And Booker runs first against Sharp James in 2002, and almost defeats a very strong run with charter schools, and he's backed big time by charter school activists. And this emboldens the movement, the national movement. But it's, you know, it's this anti-racist initiative. And in 2006, he is elected as the mayor of Newark, and he begins the kind of shock therapy, which we can kind of get into with your subsequent questions, the shock therapy privatization of public schools in Newark, which is part of a national initiative.
So I want to build on this idea about school achievement and the gap between Black and white students, and that being framed as a civil rights issue and thus the civil rights issue of our time. So you write about how Booker and his coalition set an agenda that centered that Black-white achievement gap, how they framed it as the civil rights issue. What did that framing make possible for them to move forward? And what do you argue that it misses?
So that was the framing that this was this progressive initiative, and that choice, school choice, which fits in with kind of this whole neoliberal ideology, was central to confronting the achievement gap, right? So it's not about reducing student-teacher ratio. It's not about dealing with poverty and segregation. It's this empowerment of families through school choice. Now, this had been, you know, Booker did not start this, right? So it was in the 90s that New Jersey under Governor Christine Whitman, a Republican, passed and signed legislation creating the first charter schools, right? Publicly funded but privately run schools. And in the New Jersey case, it varies by state, but the state had to approve applications for creating charter schools. Now, just previous to that, and this is kind of goes together, and this is plays a very important part in the subsequent struggle in Newark, that the Newark's public schools were taken over by the state. And so they got rid of the school board and they were directly administered state, which allowed make it easier to, you know, to reform the schools, to put through these charter schools. But they really didn't take off until Booker comes to power in 2006. And this is just at the same time, so we have to look at the context. I'm here in New Orleans, 2005. Now, we're facing this other calamity right now with saltwater intrusion, but at that time was Hurricane Katrina. And it was a classic disaster capitalism, what Naomi Klein has talked about, disaster capitalism. The elites, political and economic elites, took advantage of that to put through policies, agendas that were much more difficult under normal conditions. And one of those was the mass privatization of the public schools. They closed the public schools. They fired all the teachers, broke the largest teachers union in the largest union in the state, and have rolled out, till this day, the only purely all charter school district. Now we might see other states going in that direction the way we see things. So Booker comes on at that time, and he works with five different foundations, the usual suspects: Gates, the Jobs, the Walmart Foundation, and a number of others, for a targeted focus. And so the foundations, who have been a prime mover of this whole movement to privatize public education, decide to come together to target several cities. All of them are majority Black. All of them the school board has been stripped of their control. And so that's New Orleans, as you would suspect, Washington, D.C., and Newark. And so this begins a big push, a lot more money coming in. There's the Newark Charter School Fund that's established. And so there's a big push there. Now, they don't have, at this point, mayoral control. It's controlled by the state. There's a Democratic governor. And although he is, this is Corzine, another Goldman Sachs guy, like the current Governor Murphy, but he's not willing, although he's done a lot of stuff to promote private, he's not willing to kind of hand things over to Booker, who's considered basically this, leading activist pushing charter schools. And it's particularly important for this movement that there's an African-American leading it. And so they make these advances, and then 3 years later, there's the election of Chris Christie, who we now know is running for president, and made some interesting comments in the debate the other day, which contradicted what he was actually doing in New Jersey with the teachers union. And so they come in, Christie comes in, and charter schools are a big he's a big champion of those as well. And so we have a Republican at the State House, and we've got in Newark, the largest city in Newark, an African-American leader in a national leader in the fight for charter schools. And so they come together in an alliance to put through basically a shock therapy, mass privatization a la New Orleans without Katrina, privatization of the schools.
So I want to hear more about Gates and Jobs and the Walton Foundation. You write about how private philanthropists play a significant role in school privatization. And here's a quote from your book. You wrote, "Discarding the public service rhetoric of an earlier era, venture philanthropy draws on business terms. As donors become investors, impact is renamed social return, and the grant list is renamed an investment portfolio." So can you tell us more about the actors you refer to as philanthrocapitalists and the role they played in Newark? And also, what is your sense, for example, what does the Walton Foundation stand to gain from school privatization? What's the motivation of these actors in supporting this agenda?
Yeah, so the philanthropists, and I call them taken from other works, philanthrocapitalists, because they are really they being, and when we're talking about education, Gates, Walton Foundation, Robertson. We'll talk a little bit more about Mark Zuckerberg as the story unfolds, but in contrast to the earlier robber barons, we're back in another gilded age, right? Yeah. But the earlier robber barons, the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Carnegies, they also took their wealth from the exploitation of the laboring class, like their contemporary version. But they had a little bit more of a civic ethic, public ethic, public good ethic. And they didn't, although it was working to promote their interests, they didn't have a tight control over their grants. In contrast, what we see with this new era of philanthropy, they don't make grants, they make investments, and they want a return on those investments. Now, I can't get into the mind of the Walmart family, but the effect or Mr. Gates or some of these other characters, but the effect is to open up public education, one of the last major sectors of the public, the last major components of the public sector. And when we're looking at states, that's the major component of their budgets. And the effect of their initiatives and their interventions have been to open up public schools to the market. That is what they have been arguing for. They say they want to improve education. They don't talk about what the research shows us about lower student-teacher ratio, about dealing with poverty, racial segregation, jobs. And, I'm a teacher. We say that, our students' living conditions are our working conditions, right? All that stuff reverberates. I'm at CUNY. A huge chunk of our students are homeless. Food insecurity, all of those issues reverberate into the classroom, and those have to be dealt with to improve education, just like through K-12. And so this is, but the way these philanthrocapitalists have played out, they really keep tight control, right? When they had philanthrocapitalists came together in 2005 and 2006, to invest in those three, they had benchmarks of what they wanted to see. It was like for Newark, it was like 40% charters. That's what they got. They got basically that. So they play a real major role in this movement. And in Newark, in the Newark case, they came in big in 2006, and then in 2009 with the Booker Christie Alliance to shock therapy. And this was kind of unveiled on Oprah's show in 2010, September of 2010. So 13 years ago, it seems like yesterday. And Mark Zuckerberg was brought on to announce his $100 million matching grant to transform Newark's public schools. And it was all about, moving it toward charters. And they wanted, and this is consistent, with the philanthrocapitalists, they wanted to put the CEO superintendent, right? So the names have changed, right? We don't have superintendent, we have CEOs. And that was a major goal of Zuckerberg's from this investment. And Booker and Christie moved quickly to do that. Now, they had some problems. They wanted this guy, Gene Broussard. Some people might know he was then the Rochester, New York superintendent. He later goes to Chicago, Barack Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, who was then mayor and also a major promoter of charters and against the union. And so in the midst of that, Broussard is brought over. Newark did not move quick enough. And so instead, they tap Cami Anderson, who comes out of the Bloomberg administration and the Joel Klein regime, school regime in New York City, which is a major promoter of charters. Bloomberg was a big promoter of Cory Booker, a big friend, an ally. And so she was put in as superintendent in 2011. So we're moving. He's elected 2006. Christie comes in 2009. We get the CEO superintendent, and they move very quickly to put through the transformations that the philanthrocapitalists, which they're implementers, which we call kind of. I take this from another work looking at the charters. They call the drivers the philanthrocapitalists, but then you have the implementers. And this was a real bipartisan effort, Republican and Democrat, to put those through. And so with Cami Anderson, the CEO superintendent, and cooperation from Newark to Trenton, the state capital, and in Washington. So we have to remember at this time, 2009, Barack Obama takes a power, and he's the most pro-charter president that we've ever had, even though his predecessors were very pro-charter. He brings in his pal Arnie Duncan from Chicago to head the Department of Education, and so they're really backing, they're providing money to localities in the midst of the Great Recession. They're dangling out federal money if reforms are put through to make it easier to fire teachers, right? Because the charter movement, the movement from above, blames school blames the teachers for the failures of public education. You need that super teacher, you need that super CEO that can get rid of all those obstacles, those bureaucratic obstacles, so they can really serve the children. And so what do you need? You need to be able to fire teachers more easily. You need to be able to close, quote unquote, failing schools. You need merit pay. So you need to be able to award those really successful teachers. And so they are able to put this through. And this brings us back to the debate yesterday. Was it yesterday or 2 days ago? The Republican debate, where Chris Christie, who's again running for president, he did that in 2016, he attacked Randy Weingarten for being an obstacle for reinventing public schools. But in fact, Randy Weingarten worked closely with the Christie administration and his school superintendent, Chris Cerf at the time, major leader, to negotiate with cooperation with the local Newark Teachers Union, this reforms that the Christie and Booker and company wanted. So they work very closely. In fact, I don't know why Christie is dissing his old friend. They went on the Morning Joe show and talked about this bipartisan cooperation. And so the AFT union bureaucracy worked hand in glove with the reformers like Christie to put through these reforms in Newark, New Jersey. But at the same time, these set the seeds, planted the seeds for the movement from below, one of the most powerful movements we've seen around the country to defend public schools, which brought in dissidents within the teachers union, community activists, and most powerfully and importantly in the Newark case, were the students in the form of the Newark Student Union.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
That is actually what I was going to ask about next. So you organized the book into two sections, or a few sections, but major sections, the movement from above and the movement from below. And with the movement from above, you describe the political elites pushing school privatization forward and battling over the idea of local control. And with the movement from below, you describe organizing from students and teachers. So can you tell us more about the movement from below and what animated students and teachers to become involved in this struggle over public education and school privatization?
Yeah, sure. So in 2012 is when the contract, the contract with Cammy Anderson at the helm in Newark, and the Newark Teachers Union was signed and then ratified, and that put through a lot of the reforms. Again, as we mentioned, at the same time there was a dissident faction of the Newark Teachers Union, which is called the Newark Education Workers, and they mounted a vote no campaign on the contract. They weren't able to block it, but they emerged as a major force among the teachers opposing the reforms. In addition, they become a number of the key activists are important in inspiring a number of their students to think critically and to mount, to begin to organize, right? One of the teachers said, you got to organize. And so in 2012 as well, the students come together to respond to this contradiction, right? On one side, there's all this talk of all this money and all this focus on Newark Public Schools. Mark Zuckerberg, this got national attention, right? This put Booker and Newark on the national spotlight. There's all this focus, but the students are experiencing worsening conditions. There are cuts that are coming down into the Newark Public Schools related to Christie giving an $800 million tax cut to the rich and having an equal amount of cut to the school budget. And so in the midst of this contradiction, the students organize, and they their big kind of coming out is a mass walkout in 2013 when the state holds a hearing in Newark. The Joint Legislative Committee on Education holds a hearing in Newark at Rutgers University, Newark, and the students organize this big mass walkout, and they're calling for, you know, local control. They're calling for an end to the budget cuts, more money for public education, democratic control, and against the privatization agenda. So they come out. And so this kind of, in the midst of this ferment, Cory Booker, who we talked about, this was his calling card, the privatization of public schools. He's the leader of this. He checks out. Now, we all know Cory Booker wants to be president. He wanted to move from the mayor's office. But a better platform, jumping off platform, springboard to the White House is the governor's office. But he couldn't wait for that. And so he exits to the U.S. Senate. And in the midst of this, an intense mayoral campaign emerges, with on one side Shavar Jeffries, who comes out of the movement. He's African-American, graduate of Columbia Law School, very elite law school. He's on the school board. He works with the KIPP charter chain. He was on their board. He's a champion of the charter schools. And on the other side is Roz Baraka, who's on the city council, activist, son of Amiri Baraka, the well-known Black activist, poet, leader of the Black Power movement. And so in Newark, it becomes a referendum. The 2014 mayoral race basically becomes a referendum on charter schools, and it becomes national attention. And despite being outfunded, outspent enormously, Baraka is able to win the election. He kind of rides that popular movement to defend public schools to City Hall in Newark. And then Shavar Jeffrey then goes on to head up the Democrats for Education Reform, the key Wall Street-backed movement within the Democratic Party to port charters. But Baraka's kind of a contradictory character. So on one side, he's aligned with the public school movement to defend public schools against the charter agenda. He denounces the whole movement from above, all the characters, the way that they opportunistically use the civil rights movement to legitimate their agenda. He calls them out on that. He's backed by the Newark Student Union. He's backed by the Newark Teachers Union, who also kind of has to kind of begin to posture militant because of this movement from below. Randy Weingarten comes to Newark to lied with him, although she negotiated that contract that pleased very much Chris Christie. Chris, I think you need to apologize for that attack on your partner that you made the other night. But on the other side, Baraka is also committed to a rent kind of hegemonic definition of economic development, of raising property values, of attracting investment to the cities, of which charter schools are a key component, right? A lot of the charter schools are located in the downtown area, are part of the renaissance. They also want to give school choice to the new gentry that are coming into the city. And so he's got to kind of, how does he kind of thread this needle? He's allied with this movement to defend public schools, right? At the same time, he's allied with the same forces that want to raise property values, of which charter schools are a key component. And so basically the argument of the book, and I hope people read and give me their feedback on it, but I argue he was able to thread that needle by narrowing the focus of the movement on local control, self-determination, a black and brown city that didn't have local control, unlike the affluent white, majority white suburban districts. And so the focus became on returning local control to the local school board to do work, and separated that. So it was a racial democratic agenda and an important agenda, but separated it from the issue of the billionaires' movement to privatize public schools. And could you really have self-determination if the privatization continued at a pace which the local school board has no control over those schools? And so once he takes power in 2014, Baraka, he kind of mends fences with the charter schools. He has this education convention which brings the lambs and the wolves together to say, let's work together for the children. Although at the same time, he doubles down on the demand that Cami Anderson, the Booker and Christie appointed superintendent, needs to go. And so there is the disruption. The movement intensifies over 24 and 2015. It culminates in these massive, I have a photograph in the book, the massive student walkouts, and they converge on City Hall. They block traffic. And that really kind of seals the deal that Cami must go. And so Baraka and Christie, although Baraka had campaigned on a slogan, when I become mayor, we all become mayor. Nonetheless, he has secret meetings, closed door meetings with Christie, and they work out a deal. Right. Now let's remember, this is at the same time Christie is about to launch his campaign. This is 2015. He's about to announce his campaign for president. He needs to quiet Newark, right? This would not look good, especially if he wants to portray himself as someone that can build bridges with the Democrats to put through neoliberal reforms, if we've got a mass disruptive movement in Newark. And so they cut a deal where they set out a roadmap for local control. The state agrees to that eventual roadmap, but they replace the superintendent, Cami Anderson, with another character, Chris Cerf, who's even more influential in the national movement to privatize charter education. He's from Montclair, New Jersey, another kind of element of the story that's a nest of the charter activist around the country, and that's where he lives. But he's brought in as the superintendent, and there's no agreement on stopping the proliferation of charters. And so we get local control, a roadmap to local control, where an increasing percentage of the students in the schools are in private charter schools, of which there is no local control. So it's a very contradictory situation. And so with the signing of the deal, the movement is kind of contained, right? Baraka is able, with Christie being very ecstatic over that, to quiet Newark, right? So the movement, the focus overwhelmingly becomes on local control, and the issue of charters is put to the wayside, is moved to the side. And Baraka increasingly builds bridges with the charters. And so they run the charter movement, and Booker run a united slate for the school board candidates, where previously Baraka had run his slate against the pro-charter forces. And so they solidify, they close ranks. And there's a number of other different initiatives in which Baraka solidarizes with the charter movement. And this does upset some elements of the movement from below. But because of his influence, unlike Booker, his predecessor, because of his long roots in the community, him being funded by the labor unions, that was basically the major funder for his campaign, he is able to kind of silence any kind of opposition from that previous movement. And that's where, and you know, that's kind of where the book ends. And then it's all about, you know, as an activist, I went into graduate school to think more deeply about the movements that I've been in and how we can really build a real popular working class alternative. And these are very serious times that we're in. Right. And so that was, you know, the last chapter is looking at the conclusion. What are the lessons from Newark for building that movement? And we're in a crisis of kind of this neoliberal model. That's the focus of the book, right? That emerges really at, you know, Jimmy Carter's about to exit. It began really with the second half of the Jimmy Carter administration and obviously deepens with the Reagan administration. But then it continues on in a bipartisan manner with Clintonism and Obamaism. But clearly it's what Gramsci calls, we're in an organic crisis. People don't believe the story that neoliberalism and its backers provide, right? It doesn't have that same ideological hold, and it isn't able to deliver the goods, the material goods. And so we're seeing a real polarization on one level in the United States and you know, globally, we've got some real dangerous authoritarian, I would call them fascist characters, that are emerging. And they're providing a solution, right? Their vision of a solution. And if we, the popular forces on the left, don't provide one, they will. And so maybe, yeah, I mean, there's some lessons around democratic control of over our movements. That's really important. I think it's a lesson from Newark of providing a kind of comprehensive alternative. The neoliberal agenda is a comprehensive alternative. We need, and then the fascists are providing theirs. We need to have an alternative set of demands and vision for the world that we're fighting for. And I think we as educators are well positioned to mount that demand, right? Because as I mentioned earlier, you know, some of our teacher activists say our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. That's true. But also we need to go farther and say our students' living conditions are our working conditions. And so we need an alternative program of demanding well-funded free education from kindergarten through university, right? We need health care, free health care, housing, transportation, an alternative model, and the rich have to pay. And you know, we've got to end our war machine. We're not going to be able to do that. That's kind of a program that we can really build a movement against. A movement for, against the attacks that we're facing, right? And we see now there's an intensification of the attack on public education, right? It's in the post-pandemic period. And so to the lessons from New Orleans, from Newark, and many other cities, we've got to have a comprehensive program democratically arrived at and to fight for it uncompromisingly. That's the way forward. That's the lesson that I take from the heroic. It was an important movement in Newark, but it didn't go as far as it could have.
Thank you so much for taking us through the book and giving us the details of what happened and the lessons that you draw from it. I encourage listeners to find a copy of the book and check it out. As we're wrapping up here, I'll ask our final question, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm trying to get the word out about the book. You know, we have to be our own best publicists. And so I really want to thank you, Laura, for opening up your venue. For this was really fun, a really good discussion. I have a talk, if anyone's in the New Orleans area, at the end of the month, Professor Cody Melchor in the sociology department is organizing a talk. And there's a number of other venues. So anyone out there is interested in inviting me on your podcast or for a talk at your school or labor union community group, I'm very happy to do that. If I'm in your city, I can show up in person. But as we've learned with the pandemic, we can Zoom all around the world. So I'm working on that. And then, longer term, I want to focus a successful movement. Right. So Newark, New Orleans was kind of defeat. Newark was kind of a mixed bag, but we have a clear cut victory in Newark, New Jersey, a struggle I was involved in to close all the ICE detention centers, which we called concentration camps, in the state of New Jersey, the publicly run one. And there's the private one that's about to be closed. And so that was kind of a clear cut victory under the Trump administration. This happened all under Trump. And so I want to focus in on that really powerful movement and the lessons for that.
Sounds great. I look forward to following that when you have it out. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.